All aboard and welcome back to another episode of the Freedom Train podcast series. I am Joseph Ward and he is Patrick Al Darius, and we back for another week getting down, staying down, and being down. Hey, so we see y'all like that condom talk. We see y'all like us talking about condominiums. We see y'all them views on that condom video. Hey, I just want to say appreciate the views on the condom video. We love that. So this week we're going to talk about condoms again. No, I'm just playing. We ain't, but we just want to say we love everybody who was checking us out, and make sure y'all share that video and also share our other videos as well. We're talking about good sex and all that stuff out there. But welcome back to another episode of the Freedom Train podcast series. Like I say, Joseph Ward, Patrick Irvin, we here, do our thing. Remember, we are brought to you by PAX Inc., PACTSINC, and PAX Inc. is a Black think tank organization that uses its resources to improve the conditions of the Black community and being a resource to the Black community. Visit the website www.pactsinc.org for more information about the organization, how you can support, donate, and even become a part of the organization. And also check out the Amazon Smile program while you're on the website. Make sure you check out our Freedom Train website at www.freedomtrainradio.com, where you can see my face. I got my shirt off. I got some OnlyFans type pictures on my section. So make sure you check that out. Patrick, he just on his. So his ain't like mine. Mine's is extravagant. So make sure you check that out. Really going down in the side. What's going on, Pat?
You know, nothing, man.
And they try to lie. Shit. I can't call it. And a goddamn thing going on here. See,
I was trying, but nothing.
It wasn't. You got to be quicker than that.
Hey, man. I had to take my glasses off. But yo, I be taking my glasses off for the glare. Hey,
let's start with Mr. Bobby Love. So, the year was 2015. The month was January, and Cheryl Love was about to make herself tea. This was part of her morning routine. Her husband Bobby was fast asleep in their bedroom when she heard a knock at the door. I opened the door slowly and saw the police standing there, Love said in an interview with Humans of New York. At first, I was worried, she continued. Their next door neighbor was known to be the crazy lady, and police officers often came and checked in on her. Cheryl assumed the police were simply knocking on the wrong door. But the moment I opened the door, she said, 12 officers came barging past me, she said. No way of knowing at the time, but Cheryl's life was about to turn upside down. They went straight back to the bedroom and walked up to Bobby. Cheryl said as she recalled vivid memories of those distinctive FBI letters glaring out from the back of their jackets. Cheryl overheard the officers interrogating her husband. What's your name? Bobby Love, her husband answered. No, what's your real name? Love's husband whispered in such a soft voice she couldn't catch the answer. You've had a long run, the officers responded. The next thing Cheryl knew, Bobby was in handcuffs and being rushed out the door. Cheryl begged to know what was wrong. This goes way back, Cheryl, back before I met you, he called over his shoulder as he was hustled out of their home. His real name is Walter Miller. And Walter Miller, a.k.a. Bobby Love, grew up in the 60s in North Carolina. Where you at, Pat? He was down the street from you. He described his childhood as pretty normal, but he grew up poor and his mother struggled to make ends meet. With 8 children to care for, she barely had enough to support all of them. It wasn't surprising that Walter began feeling neglected. His run-ins with the law started when he attended a Sam Cooke concert. The crowd was really moving because it was dance music, and Sam Cooke didn't like that. He kept telling people to sit down. After only 2 songs, he walked off the stage. Walter said he yelled profanity at the stage and was subsequently arrested for misconduct. Things went downhill pretty quickly after that, he said. That's kind of interesting that him cussing out Sam Cooke for walking off stage at a concert would cause his life to go downhill. That's interesting. Like just the psychological part of me just like, really? You getting kicked out of a Sam Hill concert for cussing out Sam Cooke because he walked off stage, started your criminal history. Like, what kind of OGs did you have? like the bar was that low?
Yeah.
That's a low bar. Come on, Pat. You got this. That's a very low bar. Hey. I took a Snickers. Uh-oh. I need to go join the game. What? Just that part. I'm sorry. That's out of the whole article. That's like the first thing that jumps out to me. Cause you know I'd be picking out stuff, but just your life goes downhill because you got kicked out of a Sam Cooke concert for cussing out Sam Cooke. Okay.
I wonder if that's just them trying to pick a genesis. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, but they're saying that's what he said.
Well, I want even with him though, I wonder if that's him just trying to pick
could be.
Be wanting to say I cussed out Sam Cooke.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know what I'm saying? Just to put it out there, I cussed out Sam Cooke. Yeah.
Hey, man.
Yeah.
Every hero and villain has an origin story. So his is so one day I was at a Sam Cooke concert and he got mad, walked off the stage, and I said, "Forget you, effer." And everything went downhill from there.
Right. Because I'm legitimately wondering if he just wanted to tell people he cussed out Sam Cooke and this is the way to do it.
I think he did. So let me continue. So the incident at the Sam Cooke concert happened in 1964, and Walter soon developed his own record of misbehavior. Things worsened rapidly for him. "I got into all sorts of trouble," Walter admitted. "I lifted purses from unlocked cars. I was stealing government checks out of mailboxes. I got bolder and bolder," Walter said. When he was caught stealing from the band room at the school, the young delinquent had to face the consequences of his petty crimes. He was sent to a nearby juvenile detention center. Juvenile detention "I hated everything about that place," Walter recalled years later. One moment he was enjoying his youthful freedom. The next, he was living a life of strict code and conduct. He complained about everything at that place, but it was the violence that really got to him. Other young delinquents in the place were far more violent than he was. "I still have scars from all the times I got beat up," Walter said, years after he had left the center. He used to hear the train whirl past every night as he fell asleep, and with its comforting noise came dreams of leaving the center. Walter wanted to get out. He just needed to think of a solid plan. The nightly sound of the train was a haunting reminder to Walter of the things he was missing out on. "I always wanted to know where the train was going," he said. His time at the juvenile center was testing his patience, so he watched for a chance to escape. Walter's golden opportunity came one night when the night guard stationed by the exit doors turned his back and checked the time. Walter saw his chance and made a run for it. "I ran out the back door toward the sound of that whistle. And that was the first place I ever escaped from," he said. "It wouldn't be the last." Dun, dun, dun. Walter ran towards the track and did something he had been dreaming of for months. He wanted to see where the train led. He followed it out of North Carolina and bore down to Washington, D.C. for the first time in months. He felt like things were finally looking up. As luck would have it, Walter had a brother living in D.C. He stayed with him and enrolled at a local high school. He began attending classes and even played baseball with friends. Unfortunately, Walter started hanging out with the wrong group of kids. His life was getting set to change once again. The group of new friends got into more serious crimes than those Walter had previously been involved in. They had been robbing banks and so far had never been caught. Their trick was to drive down to North Carolina to do the deed because the security there was more relaxed. And that's going to be a theme for Walter going back to North Carolina. Okay. Walter and his friends got away with many heists. After every score, we'd hang out in the strip on 14th and T Street and act like big timers. We felt like gangsters. In a moment of honest reflection, Walter admitted, "I have nobody to blame but myself. I just enjoyed the feeling of having money." He would soon see he wasn't so lucky after all. Walter and his friends conducted several successful bank robberies. However, August of 1971, they were finally caught. The operation backfired on them when they decided to rob a bank that had a silent alarm system. The bank teller was able to use the system to alert the police without Walter and his friends noticing. Upon leaving the bank, Walter discovered the police were waiting for him in the parking lot. I tried to get away, ducking and weaving, running through cars, he said. However, this behavior only led to him being shot and caught. Still, this indomitable young man was going to find a way to flout the system once again. Aside from this last failed robbery, Walter was found guilty of one other. His sentence was 25 to 30 years in prison. As if things couldn't get any worse, Walter learned that his mother had passed away. This was a devastating blow to him, and he vowed to turn his life around. Walter made several appeals, but none were successful. By this time, he had already gotten used to spending time behind bars. Still, he wanted a better life for himself, so he hatched a plan to be transferred to a maximum security from a maximum security prison to a minimum security facility. Walter wanted to make positive changes in his life. I became the perfect inmate, he said. I never had a mark on my record. His good behavior earned him the privilege of being transferred to a minimum security facility. This new locale was a fresh start for Walter. I felt like camp compared to this previous facility. Though there were still towering walls and fences and guards on duty, inmates had more freedom to do pleasurable things. They were afforded calls to family and loved ones and were allowed to walk outside. Walter even had the chance to host his own radio show. At that time, he had no plans of escaping, but things were about to change. Things felt relaxed for Walter for the first time in years. He was thoroughly enjoying his time as a radio show host, and his time in the minimum security system was the best he had felt thus far. But things took a turn for the worse when a fellow inmate shouted profanities at the prison captain. The captain assumed it was Walter, and things were never the same after that. The captain kept on calling Walter out regularly, writing infractions. The negative reports kept piling up until I was one mark away from being sent uphill, he said. He didn't want to leave, and he knew this was his only chance to escape. Because of the pile of negative reports against him, Walter was given one of the toughest jobs in the prison. He was assigned to clean rows with a few fellow inmates. He had to wake up much earlier than the rest of the prison population, ride a bus to Riley, and pick up the trash along the road. It was awful, he recalled. People would be throwing hamburgers and milkshakes at you, and it was almost winter, so it was starting to get cold. Despite these dire conditions, Walter saw this as an opportunity to plan his next escape. Dun, dun, dun. This was when I started planning and plotting, he said. To fund his grand scheme, Walter began saving up his money. He also started to take note of small details. He noticed that the guard stationed at the door on Tuesday was lazier than the rest. He didn't give any of the inmates a pat down, letting them leave the facility and head to the bus with no idea as to whether they were carrying anything they shouldn't have. Walter also noticed that on their way out, they would always stop at a certain intersection that had a wooded area right beside it. The crafty young man spent months collecting information to ensure his plan would be a success. Then one Monday night while watching TV, Walter made his final decision. That was going to be my last night in prison, he said. The following day, the lazy guard was stationed at the door. Walter was prepared for his big escape. He had cleaned out his locker and had the civilian clothes he was allowed to wear for his radio show underneath his prison suit. Everything was set. Walter made sure to sit at the very back of the bus where the emergency exit was. As we slowed down for a stop, I swung open the back door and I was gone, he said. He stripped his prison clothing right away and ran deep into the woods. The sound of police sirens faded into the distance as he ran. I could hear the alarm blaring behind me, but I didn't look back, Walter said. When he felt safe enough to let his guard down, he began to inquire about where the nearest Greyhound station was. Keep going, was the reply. A kind stranger was nice enough to lend Walter some money to buy a one-way ticket to New York City. As he settled into his seat, the woman beside him turned and struck up a conversation. She asked me my name. I thought for a moment and said, Bobby Love. And that was the death of Walter Miller. That was it. Walter was about to start a brand new life. So basically, just to sum, it's a long-ass article, so I just want to give y'all that context. So sum it up. Walter, now Bobby, moved to New York. And he moved to New York. He started a new life. He got him a job. He met the woman, Cheryl. Him and Cheryl met at church. Walter actually went to church, started going to church, was seen as a good man in church. He met Cheryl in church. Boy meets girl, girl meets boy. Walter and Cheryl fell in love. He wooed her. He dropped it off in her back. Bam. Walter and Cheryl are in love. Walter and Cheryl have four children. And this is 40 years later, Walter is home. Walter and Cheryl and everybody are home, and they chilling. Then the FBI come busting in and get Walter. And how Walter got caught? Walter, and I told you a theme of going back to North Carolina. Walter actually went back to North Carolina to go to a funeral of one of his family members, which he shouldn't have did. When he went back to the funeral, he made contact with other family members and people who knew that he was on the run. Somebody called the police and tipped off the police that Walter, aka Bobby Love, was back in town. And that's how they tracked him all the way back to New York, busted in his dough in 2020, kicked in and took him back to jail after 40 years and disrupted his new family's life, because now you have four children and a wife who have no idea of who you really are and your background and where you come from. Because Cheryl was always talking about how he didn't talk much about his past, and especially leading up to the funeral or time after the funeral, he was real jumpy about certain questions and real shaky. He felt it was almost as if he felt like somebody knew or somebody was on to him. And so she talked about how it was difficult to kind of really bond with him in some aspects because of his shakiness or his jumpiness, because he was on the run. She had the goddamn man been on the run. She had no idea he was on the run. And she was like, all right, so now I could put two and two together, because I see that he would react certain ways to certain things because he was an escaped convict on the run. He lasted 40 years. He lasted 40 years, and he would have lasted longer if he wouldn't have went back home to his funeral. But now, like I say, you have this family who's like, man, what the hell? They done took our daddy. And of course, they want to defend their father. And I think Cheryl is defending him, well, more so on his side, I would say, and trying to help him get out or get restitution and things like that. But I just thought it was a crazy story. It's like something, I think they're probably going to make a movie about this. I think I did read that they're going to try to make a movie about this. But this is something that you see in movies or you read about in books. You never really think you'll come across some article like this in real life of a guy, like especially a black man in America who's been on the run for 40 years and just really just go start a new life, a new family, have four whole kids, like ain't nothing going on. And then one day their whole life is just ripped apart. That's some crazy shit, Patrick. Bruh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bobby Love, I mean, man.
It is some movie shit. It absolutely is. I had my laptop out reading as you was looking at the same article. They're probably all gonna make a movie about it. I see that coming. I think there are already like actors and actresses and whatnot that are like tweeting and Instagramming. What do they call when you post on Instagram? Is that called Instagramming?
Posting.
Well, they already talking about it on social media. So I'm sure at some point somebody's going to make it a movie out of it. What I found interesting is a couple of the articles I read where they talked about why he didn't tell his wife. He said he didn't tell her because she was a righteous woman, and he knew that she would encourage him to turn himself in. But she also said that he would.
Yeah, that's why he didn't tell her.
Yeah. But she also said he would regularly say things like, I'm not going anywhere unless somebody comes and takes me.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was and that's around the time he was very shaky and wasn't really forthcoming to her, because He was starting to, his spidey senses was turning like, man, they finna come get me.
Yeah, and like there's a lot to learn from this story, in my opinion.
Yeah.
A whole you got to lot
get
to know
to you re- you really got to get to know people and they
Right. Because I'm sure the family justifiably feels like the government or the police came and ripped their family apart. But the truth of the matter is,
he did.
Right.
So for our listeners now, viewers, let me read this. So after he's caught, so Cheryl did everything she could to get her husband out of prison. She composed letters of appeal to the governor and even sent one to President Obama himself. Their children and anyone who knew the family wrote testimonials about Bobby's life. I didn't know a thing about Walter Miller, she said, but I told them all about Bobby Love. After all this hard work, Cheryl brought a massive number of testimonials to Bobby's parole board, so his case could be appealed and hopefully overturned. It seemed like an impossible request, but after a year behind bars, the parole board agreed to let Bobby go. He was to continue his new life, but things wouldn't be quite the same. That's interesting. That's interesting because he's actually guilty. And we know, and so it's I'm gonna say two things for this. So it's interesting because he's actually guilty, and he's actually even guiltier because he escaped. But I guess they were, so with the testimonials, they were able to prove good behavior and a change in him. But we, and I'm not mad at it. I'm not saying it like I'm mad at it, but it's interesting that this is happening. We see this happen to a black man because usually the story is, whether guilty or not, your ass going to jail and you're going to spend more time than you need to. And so, it's also an example of proper or adequate, or not proper, but adequate advocacy.
Yeah. I would say. No, I'm not even going to front. The story bothers me. But that's because I am a very by the book type of person. The law say this, you do this. The rules say this, you do that. And I'm that way because, you know, as a black man in America, you usually aren't given any leeway. You know, if you even give the appearance of breaking the law, they're going to hit you over the head as hard as they can.
Right.
But, and so I'm also thinking about a lot of the people I know that had advocacy that didn't do nothing. Like, I got family members that have served years in prison for being an accomplice to a bank robbery, and the guy, their friend, Rabbit is, called them up and asked them to come pick them up. They came and picked them up and didn't know that they were picking them up from a bank that they had just robbed.
Right.
But they still had to spend years in prison, even with people telling that story of, wait, this is what happened. Even with the person that actually robbed the bank saying,
telling that story.
Yeah, he didn't know what was going on. I called him. He came and picked me up. He still had to serve years in prison. He didn't escape. He didn't any of that. So when I see stories like this, I'm not even going to lie, it kind of bothers me a little bit.
Because it does bother me, but it's kind of part of my brain. It's like, all right, white people, 17 million. Black people, 17. But it's like, still it's kind of cringe because we know so many innocent black men that are serving time for things that they haven't done, who's been able to prove improved behavior, or even people who have done things who've showed an improvement in behavior or a change of behavior. But let's just talk about people who haven't done anything, whose behavior don't need to improve because, hell, they didn't do nothing. And it can't get a break. But this guy escaped. This guy was on the run for 40 years and was got caught. It took him back. He only spent the year, and he got out because of testimonials and adequate advocacy.
Yeah. And again, for me, it's not a shot to the family or anything like that.
It's the system.
It is the system. I'm going to be honest. I'm saying it's not a shot to the family, the wife, the children. They didn't have nothing to do with it. I do look at him sideways for whatever it's worth. I mean,
it's all his fault. All this is his fault because he brought all this on his family.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I know since you shared the story with me, and I told you I glanced over it, but one of the things I was doing was looking to see what the reception to the story was. Like, what were people saying about it? Because to me, that's the conversation. The events have happened, but how is it being received? and you have people calling him a hero, calling her a hero, saying that this is an example of what's up.
How is he a hero?
I don't see how there are any heroes in this story.
Because that would mean the bar for being a hero is kind of low. Because what's heroic about escaping prison?
I mean, I view it the same way as, like, it's unrelated, but hear me out. So I was watching the video earlier from somebody who was talking about how they repaired their credit score, right? And they were talking about how they had all of these charge-offs and all of these other things on their credit report, and their credit score was, like, the absolute lowest it could be. It was, like, a 350 or something like that, right? And so they said the way they got out of it was they just didn't pay any of the collections or charge-offs, and after a period of years, all of that stuff fell off. They got a couple summons. They got sued a couple times, but they just persevered, right? And now they have, because all of this was decades ago, now they have a credit score that's in the 700s, 800s, right? And just reading the comments underneath that video of everybody saying this person persevered and they're a role model because of their strength. And I think it was the way they were telling the story. But to me, it seems like anytime anybody goes through any kind of hardship, regardless of the cause of it, somebody wants to call them a hero. And what bothers me about this way of doing things is we're encouraging people to not be accountable for their actions.
That's bullshit. That's all that what them people saying. No, that, and you can tell them Joseph Ward said that's bullshit.
I agree.
Because so everything you're saying, like with the credit store, you guess what? In the first place, don't run your credit up. Or if you do, there are quicker and more and better ways to improve your credit score without you digging a ditch. Because basically what Buddy said is he messed his credit up. He put himself in an even deeper hole and then just persevered and just dug his way out. And people just start cheering them. You cheering people, like you said, for making bad decisions.
No,
you're not. That's not heroic. Making bad decisions over and over and over is not heroic. Okay.
Absolutely not.
I mean, hell, after 10 years, something had better change after 10 years.
It's the same thing with this story, right? The dude had been robbing banks and stuff for a period of time before he got caught, escaping from places and doing things for a period of time. He got caught. And then after he escaped again, decided, I'm going to be a different person. Well, after a period of time, you would hope that you wouldn't still be the same person that got locked up. But the fact of the matter is, you still committed a crime. And you didn't pay for it.
Right. And he wasn't totally a different person because you still lying to everybody.
Right. You built the whole family off a lot. I know there are a lot of people that are going to say, well, yeah, but he's a black man, so I don't care anytime any black man get. No, that's not. Because the way, and I'm going to shut up after I say this. The way I view this story going public like this makes it harder for every other black man in America, in my opinion. Because here is a black man that got convicted, is a known guilty, and got off on serving his sentence for committing the crime and then for escaping and being on the run for 40 years. Right? He got off. So now people, like, life is a team sport, right? Anytime anybody does one thing, everybody has to pay for it, or everybody gets the praise for it. Because of this, the way America works in my mind, people are going to be using this as an example of black people always get in the way with shit, and so they don't deserve any sort of leeway that they get. You know what I'm saying? Like, how this is going to be spun.
Yeah, I get where you're coming from. I do get where you're coming from. It just I can't all the way rock with this because I know this all the way ain't right. Right. And like I said, we talked about the score, 117 million for white people.
Yeah,
and
I get all that. Absolutely.
And we get it, but it's still, you know, it's not heroic at the end of the day. I'm not mad at him. He's not a hero in my book. But he still doesn't seem like a person you could fully trust because everything was built upon a lie. Everything about him is a lie.
Right.
Everything is a lie. And you carry this lie on for 40 years. So your criminal history just evolved. You went from these type of crimes to this. And you added in deception and scamming and all that stuff in there.
Yeah, because I mean
you everything is a facade about that. And so like can you really be trusted?
I mean, I would, because for something this big, right? Like this ain't like you got vaccinated and I ain't tell nobody.
Bruh,
right?
Imagine the FBI come kick in your door and just you and your siblings in there, like you and your sisters and your mom in there, and the FBI come kick in your door and snatch your daddy out. And then you find out that, yeah, it's your daddy, but you don't even know who this person is because this person is living a whole nother life.
They didn't change their name, got a new birth certificate,
you a whole criminal,
social security number,
a whole living criminal.
Like you got a whole forced identity.
Because it's one thing to be reformed. We're not talking about somebody who's reformed. We're talking about, bro, you still in the act of criminality.
Yeah, because you on the run.
I'm just saying. Like I said, I ain't mad at him. It just he wouldn't be somebody I would leave my wallet around.
No, I don't feel bad for him. I feel bad for the children.
And the wife.
Yeah,
they were the ones who suffered the most because the deception is more of a negative impact on his wife and his family and his children than anybody else.
Yeah. And then the reason you give as to why you didn't tell her is not a very good one, in my opinion.
Right.
So I know she's gonna encourage me to turn myself. That's what needs to happen.
So that's further indication that you have not changed, if we're being real.
But we know that they're going to put a spin on it when the movie comes out. It's going to be a tale of ultimate love and all of this other stuff, I'm sure. Go ahead.
And especially if the crimes you were committing were against other black people too. Because I'm not sure. So let me state this. I'm not saying his crimes was, because I have no way of knowing that. I have no information to say who his crimes were against. But I'm just saying if his crimes were against black people, then I mean.
Well, I mean, you know,
there's still some
like
reformation need to happen.
Absolutely. Because from my viewpoint, you still have gotten off without paying for what you did. Like you still, not only do you have a debt to society, you have a debt to your family.
Yeah.
That you was more than content with. Like at some point, because in one of the articles I read, it said he told his sister to tell his wife after he died.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
But I'm not saying he's depicted as a hero, but if so, that's crazy.